a little like that camel. I'm afraid this might be lumpy and bumpy. I thought that this is a good month to talk about democracy. We just got done going to the polls, and it's a good month to talk about gratitude because Thanksgiving. And it's a good month always to talk about hope because, you know, that whole election thing, it seems like it's just rockier and rockier every time we try to do it. And that whole Thanksgiving thing, I don't know, the story's not the story I grew up with. And we keep learning new layers of what is our story. And some of those involve coming to terms with painful things. So I had in mind something where I could try to retrieve democracy and analyze what is good about it and how it does work or how it could work and how if we're grateful enough, we can overcome all this and we can live in hope of, and I'm not quite there. So here's where I am. I think patience. I think I spent this week up in the mountains of North Carolina with other UU ministers from the Southeast region, and I was at the mountain retreat and learning center is what it's called, which is a UU place. It's a little retreat center. Some of you may have been there. Jill is nodding, and it's kind of wonderful. I think it's I think they're 40 years old this year. But there's little cabins, and there's a lodge, and there's a cafeteria where some of the food they serve, they've grown on the property, and they recycle everything and compost everything, and it's a really wonderful place. The first time I was there, there was a meeting that I was not attending, and I was kind of all alone. Everybody else was in this meeting, and I wandered into the office, and a volunteer named Harriet told me about the lichens growing on a rock down the hill outside cabin number one. And it turns out some of these lichens, the individual lichens, they're not really plants. They're, you know, algae and fungus. Some of these individuals are over 1,000 years old. I said, well, 1,000 years, I'm a historian. 1,000 years, that's a long time. It's a really long time. That's a whole lot longer than the history of Euro-Americans. Right? So I went down and looked at these lichens. And now every time I go to the mountain, that's at this pilgrimage spot for me, I go down and I look at these lichens. And sometimes I come back up and I'm telling people, they're really ugly. One of their nicknames I can't even keep in my head, but it refers to, you know, they look like something you'd scrape up off the bottom of your cast iron skillet after you're done cooking. They're kind of black, and in some seasons they're brown on top, and they're usually black on the bottom. This fall when I saw them, you know, just a couple days ago, they're green because the weather's been mild and there's been a lot of sun. So they're green and still busy photosynthesizing. But other people and other times when I go down, they're beautiful. They grow sometimes this big. And the way they know how old they are is that they grow from a center point. Sometimes they're called, I found online, navel lichens because they have sort of, it looks like a belly button. It's actually where they're attached to the rock. They send out this tendril that shoots acid into the rock and dissolves the rock so that it can anchor itself. And they're pretty firmly anchored, so you figure you have to be pretty firmly anchored to stay there for over 1,000 years. But they grow at a specific rate, scientists have found. So they can figure out that some of them are big enough that they must be over 1,000 years old. And I am in awe that they can. And it's just a big boulder. It doesn't look like anything special. The leaves fall on it and sort of, you know, get mixed in with the lichens. And then the leaves shrivel up and fall off. And the lichens are still there. And they have little tiny signs that say, please don't climb on this rock. Please don't touch these lichens. Some of them are over 1,000 years old. And it's a really little sign. And I know they let campers stay in those cabins. That cabin right there. It's just on a rock. And there they are being 1,000 years old. Just being 1,000 years old. And I think, wow, that's amazing. I'll never be that old. Never, ever, ever. And so that brought me home. And I started thinking human evolution. Wikipedia's got amazing stuff. And the conversations on human evolution are just changing all the time now. My husband's been kind of following them, so I had him talk me through a little bit of it. But there have been beings kind of like us, related to who we are, on this earth for a very, very, very long time. You know, so those lichens, and not the species that I was looking at, but the individuals I was looking at, right, were 1,000 years old. But there have been people like us walking around. Bipedalism is about 4 million years ago. I can't quite even think a million. I can kind of get there, but not really. But 4 million, we're not even sure. It was probably 15 million years ago that the two groups that became what we now call the lesser apes and the greater apes split off from each other. 15, maybe 20 million years ago. But some of those apes learned to stand up and walk about 4 million years ago. We got control of fire maybe 1.5 million years ago. My husband David says some people are trying to push that back maybe to 2 million years ago. Control of fire. 2 million years ago. Dark skin evolved about 1.2 million years ago. Probably, David said, because we started losing our fur. You know, light skin doesn't matter when you have enough fur to cover it. So Homo sapiens, which is our species, actually I guess it's our genus and then we're Homo sapiens sapiens, but anyway, there were Homo sapiens who are what's called anatomically modern 300,000 years ago. 300,000 years ago. And they lived with lots of other neighbors. There were other species related to us. And it turns out, I mean, this is just sort of my overall impression, because I'm not reading all the stuff that David's reading and studying this deeply. But it turns out that our history as a species goes back way further than we thought and is a lot more interesting and more complex. And we had a lot more company than we thought we had. And I don't know why this gives me hope, but it does. It's always been complicated. There's always been a lot going on. And so we were anatomically correct about 300,000 years ago. Anatomically, not correct, modern. Modern was the word I was looking for. Thank you. But it's really only, according to this timeline in Wikipedia, only about 50,000 years. That's 1/6 of that 300,000 that we've had people walking around basically with the same kind of bodies we have. But only 1/6 of that time have they been behaviorally modern. They're still trying to figure that one out. There's this theory of some big leap, that something cognitive happened, something changed about how we interacted with the world. But still, I'm thinking 50,000 years, that's a long time. That's a long, long time. This country, so Europeans have been on this continent less than 400 years, right? No, 500, wait. I did the math and then I didn't write it down. Not very many hundred years. Not very many. And the history of our country is even shorter than that. And the history of our country as this big, hulking thing it is really very short. Especially in the span of 50,000 years or 4 million years of bipedalism. And this all brings me actually oddly back to humility. We're very young. Democracy is a young project. The United States of America is a young project. Human beings are a young thing. We've only 50,000 years ago did something happen that allowed our brains to be in the world the way they are today. And we're still trying to figure out how to deal with that. We're still trying to, the older parts of our brains and the newer parts of our brains still trying to figure things out. So I go and I look at these lichens that have been holding on to how they are for a whole 1,000 years, yeah, or more. I think, well, maybe sometimes when I'm really worried, and I just hardly know where to look, what to think. Maybe I need to remember the patience and the persistence. You know, this is, I think, why I go down and say hello. I check in with the lichens every time I get out that way, because it seems like something that can hang on to where it is and to its center for over 1,000 years has something to teach me. And maybe it's just a sense of one's place in everything. We have been, you know, so we've been around all these long years. There's been some really interesting things going on closer to our lives. And I've now been alive long enough to realize how much some things have changed. I started reading some things about democracy and about justice, organizing social movements and those sorts of things. And I realized there was a lot going on, like, in the 70s. And in the 70s, all I was aware of was the places where my family lived. The 60s were amazing. I don't really remember them because I was a child. I was born in the 60s. So a lot of us were born in the 60s. But what I know of those times are sort of shadowy. I remember being that age, but my life was my home. My parents, my siblings. I've heard my mother talk about some of that. We lived in Arlington, Virginia when some of the riots were going on in D.C. And in the 70s, when I was older, maybe even in the 80s, she told me about her experience of working in the garden, this little suburban white picket fence surrounded garden that we had in Arlington, Virginia, and reflecting on how different her life was from the lives of the people who were in the streets in D.C., and thinking, oh, there's a connection to my being able to work in the ground here and they're not having access to anything like that. And that has to do with something that's wrong, something that's not working well, something needs to be addressed. So, but I just heard those stories later. I didn't know that at the time. And in the 70s, I lived both in Colorado and in Arlington, Virginia. So I knew there were other places, but there were things happening in the world of which I'm still not aware, because I wasn't reading the news and certainly wasn't watching broadcast news. And then I think about, you know, things that were happening in the 80s and the 90s when I was supposedly an adult. And I still didn't have as much of a sense of the texture of the world as I do now. Because now any morning I can wake up and look and see what's in the New York Times, and there's stuff from all over. Or I can look on, there's all sorts of, I talk about the New York Times all the time because I can only track one thing. And that's the one I chose. That's the subscription I paid for. You might have subscriptions other places. And there's so many places we can get so much information about what is going on. And people around the world are much closer to us than they used to be. And that is a wonderful thing, and it is, to me, sometimes an overwhelming thing. I don't know what to do with the knowledge of the wildfires in California. The numbers of people who are being killed in very short times astounds me. And I saw a map on my computer screen in my living room of the fires and the ash plumes, and they're blowing all the way over here. They're, you know, I'm like, oh my goodness. Now I can't tell looking outside, but they're touching us here in Tennessee, and I am overwhelmed by all the things that are affecting people, that are affecting my fellow human beings, that I know I don't understand fully, and I don't always know the best ways to respond to, and I know that, I trust that people, I know we care about each other. I know we want to know each other and cooperate with each other. I've told you before, some of you have heard me say, I know that we get on the highways and drive and mostly get where we're going. And that is an amazing exercise in trust, I think. If you ever think we don't trust each other, remember that we drive at 70, 80 miles an hour and come out alive. We follow rules, we all agree, and we all follow those agreements about how we go down those roads. So we do know how to trust and care for each other. I've also been reading a little bit about well, this is an amazing book. Some of you may have run into it because it's about 7 or 8 years old now. But Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. And it was done by, I believe they are both social science, well, they are social scientists. One is in an international studies and one's a strategic planner. But it's full of statistical analysis and regressions, and I can't follow most of it. Well, I could, but it would take a really long time. So I read beginnings and endings of things and let other people summarize the book for me. But they studied nonviolent movements in the 20th century and compared them statistically with violent movements, like insurgencies and revolutions. They sort of picked things carefully so statistically things would be valid. And what they found is that nonviolent resistance works better. It is successful more often, and vastly more, not just like a little bit. It's not like 60-40. It's like vastly more successful in creating, in having success, in meeting their own needs, and setting up the conditions for democracy. But the other really interesting thing, the sort of pro-democracy thing, because we are people who say we affirm democratic process. And I know we don't always agree on, A, what that means exactly, or, B, whether we really should be affirming that, because it's not the only way to run the world. But what was interesting, what they found was the reason that nonviolent strategic and tactical choices work better is that they allow for broader participation. And if you think about it, this makes sense to me anyway, immediately. Violence, we're talking soldiers. We're talking guns. We're talking special skill sets. We're talking you need supplies. And it takes a lot of money and it takes a lot of training and fewer people can be directly engaged. Nonviolent movements often recruit from a much wider spectrum of people in a given population. And they're just more nimble. And you think about, like, you know, the revolutions that happen because people are on cell phones, you know, saying, let's all go here now and say this or do that. It makes sense. And I kind of think, oh, that's democracy. It's not the go in the voting booth and vote democracy. But it is mobilization of the people, broadly speaking. And there's also parts in here where they talk about how those kinds of movements are more likely than violent, movements that depend on violence, to set up the conditions under which democracy, in the sense of voters, and voters going into booths and voting and making decisions about who leads, the nonviolent movements are much more likely to be followed by democracy than the violent movements. And again, it's not just more likely, as in, you know, 65% to 35%. It's like 90, you know. And if you want the numbers, you can come look at my book and find them later. But it's a really, really overwhelming. And even when they look at movements that fail, they tend the reasons when they figure out why a movement failed or was only partially successful, it tends to just reinforce the overall pattern that success depends on engagement of wide numbers of people from different parts of society too. So I do have hope, because we're not just learning how to do things in different ways, we're also learning how to study and to understand why things work and why they don't. And, you know, I thought about starting this sermon with Winston Churchill, he may or may not have said it, because the actual quotation is, "It has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time." In this book, they quoted, there was just a little blurb at the top of a chapter from Joan Baez. "Nonviolence is a flop. The only bigger flop is violence." So again, it's just human history is long and it's complicated and things work sometimes and don't work sometimes. And I think all the time there's information, there's feedback. We are like the biological systems in which we participate. There's feedback, there's adjustment, things change, gene pools get shifted in directions that favor survival, species adapt to each other's presence or absence. It goes on all around us, and we are part of that as well, and our behavior is part of that. We are part of the natural world. We don't live in it. We didn't come out of it. We are part of the natural world. And so it calms my soul to go and stand with those thousand-year-old lichens and just be, okay, I can just hang on. If they can hang on to this rock. And, you know, they're in the sun sometimes, some parts of the year, and they get rained on a lot because it's really wet up there. It's a little rainforest, actually. And they just hang on, and they get torn around the edges, and they hang on. And they get folded over, and they run into each other, and they just hang on. They're just there. And I'm sure kids climb over them sometimes. And actually, I read online that you can eat them. If you're ever out and you're stuck and you have no food, you can eat them and you'll survive. But they taste bad. And you should boil them a lot before you eat them. Because remember, they have acid that can dissolve the rock. But those lichens, they're just there. And people could eat them. And if we all depended on them for survival, they wouldn't be there because we would eat them all out because they grow so slowly. Which is probably why they taste bad, so that we won't eat them. But it calms my soul to go and stand with the lichens. I can hold on. And I can listen to, Winston Churchill. And he's kind of flip. I've decided, though, that he's kind of right sometimes. He said some other time, "For myself, I am an optimist. It doesn't seem to be much use to be anything else." So I'm going to say hope. Let's just hope, and let's hang on to this idea, the possibilities that we can change and grow and become who we dream of being. And we have really amazing dreams. They're great dreams. And it's been very hard in the last few decades because we come up again and again and again and again in the ways in which our dreams have failed. Or they've succeeded for some of us and failed for others. And we've not been good about understanding that. We have actually just told those others to get behind us. We're busy going there. We're getting there. You just go to the back of the line. Please don't bother me. It makes me uncomfortable. And we're learning that we can't do that. We can't all get there. The costs are too high. And we don't want to get there without all of us. I don't want to get there without all of us. And I think that those are what our Unitarian Universalist principles are about. Let's do this together. This is actually, I think, what democracy is about. This is a world that I would like to help build that I can be grateful for. And I brought some poetry for you. And it's because I am an optimist. And this is classic. I find our brothers and sisters, our kindred, our cousins, our siblings of color have had more practice than we have in holding on to that hope, clinging to that rock. And there's an old poem. I have some newer stuff, too, I've run into that's amazing. But I ran across Langston Hughes a few weeks ago. I think it was pre-election. Somebody posted a link to it somewhere. And he has a poem entitled "Let America Be America Again," which is beautiful. And I'm going to just read the whole thing because I have time today. and I want to warn you that there is language in this poem that probably wouldn't be there if it were written today. It was written in the middle of the 20th century. So Negro was an acceptable, polite word to use in those days. And Langston Hughes is, of course, a very important African-American poet of the 20th century. And also man is used as the universal. And clearly, there's somewhere in here where he says men and women, so he includes man. He means man to include men and women, and also clearly mankind used generically does not include me always, all the time. And but that's here. And I ask you to just remember it as a product of its time, but also hear it speak to us, because I think we live here still. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own good. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today despite the dream. Beaten yet today, oh, pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker bartered through the years. Yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today? The millions shot down when we strike? The millions who have nothing for our pay, for all the dreams we've dreamed, and all the songs we've sung, and all the hopes we've held, and all the flags we've hung. The millions who have nothing for our pay, except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free. The land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. America. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain. All the stretch of these great green states, and make America again. May it be so, and may we be the people who cling like lichens to that dream. Amen.